Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yes, we can podcast. Strike up the band.
Politics really matters a lot, and it's certainly not a game.
They used to say that I was Nick Clegg's brain.
Sunak's campaign. He's designing a campaign which is all wokey-cokey.
Yeah, here we are again then, doing the wokey-cokey. I'm Matt Jolly. This is How to Win an Election, your insider's guide to the huge political year ahead. Joined as ever by new Labour architect Peter Mandelson. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Matt.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Polly McKenzie, otherwise known as Nick Clegg's brain, and Policy McKenzie is here.
Also, Nigella Lawson fangirl, who has brought Christmas cake.
You have brought Christmas cake.
How are you finding it?
It's nice. It's quite boozy. It's quite boozy.
Yeah, Danny has refused to have my Christmas cake, so I'm not going to talk to him. Right, just fine. To let you know.
It's his New Year's resolution.
Yeah.
What is to not eat any more of Polly's cake?
Just to try not to eat anything that I don't absolutely have to eat.
Right. Oh, Danny's also here. Toy Brain Box, Danny Finkelstein's here. Happy New Year to you all. If you want to get in touch, you can email us howtowin@times.radio. howtowin@times.radio with all of your questions. So, it's a new year. It's been called the biggest year for democracy since democracy began or something, because more than a third of the world's population will go to the polls in some form in 2024. We'll look at some of those elections happening abroad in a moment. First of all, let's start back here. Big election year, could be the autumn, could be May. Everyone still settled on when they think it's going to be?
I'm still a possible May man.
Yeah?
Yeah, and I still think they should go in May, but they won't. They'll go in the autumn.
Well, the government has now briefed out that it will certainly be next year, which gives me even more confidence.
This year?
That's what they said it last year. What?
But you still think it might
I'm
be 2025.
January.
You might just cling on.
Well, yeah, because they were so clear that it will definitely be in 2024, but didn't specify when. Yeah, I don't trust them.
Should Rishi Sunak rule out publicly a May election if he's not going to do one, or risk the sort of Gordon Brown, Butler Brown thing? That if the idea that he's going to go in May gets legs, is that a risk for him?
He should make sure to brief out that it's unlikely. So as not to build up a head of steam, but he shouldn't rule it out altogether because he doesn't want to close down his options.
He'll hold an election when it's in the best interest of the country.
Yeah, but the problem then is Matt's right. that if you allow a story to build and build and build, you get trapped into sort of having not called an election you never intended to call.
I think Labour is certainly thinking that way. They're quite enjoying stoking up the idea that there's going to be a May election. They're the ones briefing out that it's going to happen because for them it's win-win. Either they'd quite like to do it quite soon, frankly, or they get that the bottom.
What gave
narrative.
It legs, though, Polly, was the calling the budget for March
6th. Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm.
And that seemed to pave the way for an early election being called at the end of March for May. I mean, I think that Sunak will be sort of punished either way. You know, if he rules out May, then the sort of running down the clock, the countdown begins, the media will be chasing him all over the place.
Yeah.
All the way to the autumn. If he doesn't rule it out and people are sort of left in sort of expectation. I look, either way, it's not great for him, but I wouldn't start speculating if I were Sunak about when the election is going to be.
I mean, because you've posed this question, Charles, we've answered it a few times. Wouldn't you both agree that, I mean, although we've each got our own choices of when you'd hold the election, which would be marginally better, it is quite marginal, I think. Where I always think when people start talking about turnout effects and the effects of dates and, you know, whether it matters whether the local elections is before or after a date, these things do matter a bit. I think they are pretty much... pretty marginal.
Local government elections, if they are a disaster, they'll be very... motivating for the Conservative
Party.
Sure,
that makes a difference.
It's not a lovely backdrop against which to launch an autumn campaign. But I also think the public are getting increasingly fretful and irritated by their expectation or their knowledge that an election is going to come this year. They're feeling that it is necessary to start a new chapter, and that's been deliberately postponed by the Tories for their own self-interest.
So that's why I argue, as you know, that they would be better off having a May election for all those reasons. But I wouldn't say the effect will be that big compared to the other things that we've discussed and we will discuss that will influence the results, the outcome of the election. It has an impact, but I would say it was marginal.
Yeah, I think that's almost certainly true, unless something big happens. And I think the Conservatives are hoping that something big might happen that shifts the political atmosphere. But of course, it could be a thing that makes life better for them, but it could just as easily be a catastrophe that makes life worse for them.
I think what's more important, both for Starmer and Sunak, is not to speculate about when the election is going to be, but to start sort of framing in their minds what the question is that they want to see uppermost in the voters' mind as they go into the polling booth whenever the election is called. And that framing should start now. Indeed, I gather it's going to start this week because both of them are going to make speeches.
They're all out and about. So, yeah, well, Keir Starmer's going to make a speech. Rishi Sunak is going to go and speak to real people. Let Rishi be Rishi. Which we're sort of at that point in the doom loop of somebody who's a long way behind in the polls, where we were told to let Gordon be Gordon, let Ed be Ed. Go out and meet. Don't talk to the media. We've got to go and speak to real. If only everyone could meet Rishi Sunak in person.
And Gordon met Gillian Duffy in Rochdale.
Can I ask this question to both of you? Because it's more difficult for me because I know and like him to judge this. Do you think that's good advice to Rishi Sunak? So to Gordon Brown, I didn't think it was very good advice. Let Gordon be Gordon, and it certainly wasn't very good advice. To Ed Miliband. Let Ed Miliband be Ed Miliband. I mean, it's all that you can do.
The year being a little fair to Ed Miliband, will you, Danny?
What I'm saying is it's all you can do. It was also the problem for my, somebody I very, very much admire, William Hague. It wasn't letting William Hague be William Hague, which was all that you could do. It wasn't going to move people. Do you think that if Rishi Sunak does get across his personality, it's a plus for him? In other words, this advice, let Sunak be Sunak, get across to real people. Let's put aside the question of whether, you know, he should or shouldn't do that. Let's assume that he does it. Would that help him?
But I think we're jumbling up two things. The let Sunak be Sunak, let Bartlett be Bartlett thing, right? Is one thing that... You cannot, in the end, make a person with, one kind of character be different. You can't make Boris Johnson do his red box at night. You can't make Keir Starmer very funny. You know, that you can only be your authentic self, and you're probably best when you do that. But why is that the same as get out and talk to the voters one-to-one? Because, you know, someone like Bill Clinton was amazing one-to-one, magic, greeting people, magic, doing town halls, could change the mood of a room, and you would get footage of that personableness. Rishi Sunak's authentic character has many strengths to it, but they're not personableness with members of the public that he meets in the street. So I just don't understand why the two things have been equated.
I agree with Polly. I think that if Sunak does this, he will come across as he usually does when he's with people, sort of awkward and rehearsed. I think that's the problem. I think he's got to do something rather different. I think he's got to construct a case for Sunak, for his government, and for the re-election of the Conservative Party. And he needs to start that this week.
So there's this thought that this all comes from this let Bartlet be Bartlet. But in fact, it comes from let
the West,
It doesn't. It comes from let Reagan be Reagan. And let Reagan be Reagan, which was the original use of this phrase, was a campaign by the right in the Conservative Party against his more centrist advisers that Reagan should be his authentic Conservative self. Let Reagan be Reagan. Yeah. The reason I think let Ed Miliband, for example, be Ed Miliband is I think authentically Ed Miliband was well to the left of where he then decided to present himself, and therefore it wasn't good advice for him. And I think also with Gordon Brown, letting Gordon Brown actually be what he really was would have also moved him, you know, against, for example, the agenda of sort of more austere spending that Alistair Darling put in place. So it was not good advice to him. And the question about whether letting Sunak be Sunak is good advice is not so much let Sunak be Sunak would make him look awkward. It's the question of whether him expressing his authentic politics.
Danny,
would be
what
good.
Would it be?
That's exactly the question.
We've already got a slight problem in him going out and being completely spontaneous with members of the public on Thursday. We've been told in advance what he's going to say because they've briefed the Times today, Tuesday, which sort of slightly undermines the idea he's just going to spontaneously react.
But I don't think that's what it means. I think letting Sunak be Sunak, as far as I was concerned, would be to let him say what he really thinks. So what do I think his actual politics are? I think he is quite small state conservative. So he's a fiscal conservative, and I've always said to him, you're a fiscal conservative like I am, but you're at a lower level of public spending and tax than I am. I think he's relatively socially liberal. I think he's quite conventional in terms of the rule of law and not doesn't have a populist position. So he'd be resistant on to make, for example, woke, the wokey cokey, in which he'd be more likely to be out than in. He's less likely to make that as a sort of centrepiece. I think some of this tech bro stuff that he's accused of, he regards as an asset and would project. So the question is whether that combination, given the Conservatives' position, is really a viable one for him. It probably isn't.
Polly, do you think Rishi Sunak would be doing better if he'd got Dominic Cummings on board, as we discovered he discussed at the weekend of the Sunday Times?
Well, I think there's two aspects to that. The first is, would he be better in terms of his policy stance? You know, as far as Cummings has briefed it out, it's something to do with cutting taxes and putting more money into the NHS, which was the sort of reality-defying maths.
Everyone wants. Taxes and more money.
Okay, well, exactly. But at the core of what Boris Johnson was sort of attempting to pull off. And I certainly think that from a political perspective that is appealing to the public, it is, of course, not really possible to pull off. And so, and both as a personality level and also then in terms of setting up a policy conflict with his party, I think that he would just be struggling so badly to hold that Conservative parliamentary party together if he had brought this kind of public enemy number one for quite a lot of them back into the tent, especially when he promised explicitly that he wouldn't.
I look at it in a slightly different way. I mean, first of all, I think that bringing outsiders, you know, into the tent and asking them from, you know, they have a detachment. They can offer a helicopter view and they're sometimes much better at sort of expressing a direct, clear-cut view than some of the people inside the tent have grown accustomed to doing. And I think that what the Conservatives need is a clarity of purpose and strategy. They need cut through. And that means a very clear, decisive conclusion about what sort of campaign they're going to mount, what the question is they want to be uppermost in voters' minds when they go into the polling booth. And I think that, you know, toxic as he is, you know, he is a fairly practiced and well-experienced campaigner, Cummings, and I think he could bring that clarity. Another thing he could bring is this. What he shares with Rishi Sunak is an intense dislike of Boris Johnson and of Liz Truss. And you see, what I think about Sunak is that he's got to get that cut through, he's got to reconstruct a narrative, a story about himself, rooted in his time as Chancellor and his early time as Prime Minister, where he was clearing up the mess created and left for him by Johnson and Truss. Now, I think, therefore, he, in order to make the case for Sunak and all the remedial action and policies he adopted after the disaster of those two prime ministers, he's got to contrast himself with those prime ministers. He's got to show what he did to clear up the mess. Now, that is not comfortable for the party, but I do think it's something that the country would appreciate and would like to hear. And they would much better see the case for Sunak as not Johnson, not Truss, the guy who cleared up things after they'd gone. That would sort of come strike home to them much better than sort of, you know, are you a small state, big state, what level of taxation? He's got to say something that the public will understand.
Yeah,
I would agree with that. And so the question is, I mean, Let Sunak be Sunak is different from Let Sunak be Cummings, and that's very important, right? Because you can see from the things that Dominic Cummings is not saying in this weekend, you know, bring me in and we'll together devise a strategy that will work. He says, I've got a strategy, and if you want to adopt it, you should bring me in. But it's not the strategy that sits comfortably with who Rishi Sunak is.
That is the risk of Cummings.
Yes, I mean, it's only one of the risks of Cummings. but get it out, just to be clear, Dominic Cummings is very clear-thinking and clever. I read a lot of his stuff. I find it completely compelling. But he wouldn't be my first choice as my kind of aide and confidant just because of the record that he's got.
Can I ask you a question?
He's much better at writing these things down than he is at that.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you think Cummings would say to Sunak, you know, there are two variations of a theme here for your campaign. One is, you know, Britain's turning a corner. It's getting better. Don't let Labour ruin it. It's a risk with Labour. But premised on Britain's sort of going in the right direction? Or should he just say, look, we all know, not say literally, we all know that Britain's gone to hell in a handcart. You know, we're in a serious mess here. It's going to take everything, you know, we've got to throw at this to make it better. Better the devil you know in the Conservatives than the devil you don't in
Labour. I think he would say, Britain's going to hell in a handcart, don't let Labour ruin it. So I do find it, it's an inconsistent message.
Well, that's the view of the UK election. Up next, we're going to take a look at some of the elections around the world. Everyone's brought in an election to talk about. So we'll do that next here on How to Win an Election.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Don't forget, if you're enjoying How to Win an Election on the podcast, you can listen to it live on Times Radio every Tuesday morning from 10, and you can catch Politics Without the Boring Bits every single weekday, Monday to Friday, from 10 till 1. Find me on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. Now, though, it's back to this week's episode. Yeah, it's How to Win an Election with me, Matt Chorley, joined by our political masterminds, Peter Madison, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein. While we've been talking, Phil in Blackpool's been in touch. Could you ask your panel, have they seen or heard from Ed Miliband and discussed his policy with him, and will it be in the manifesto? So, Peter, let's be fair to Ed Miliband.
Which policy are you talking about?
I think he means the £28 billion green package, okay, which ever since it's been announced, no one wants to talk about the Labour Party.
I don't think that's right or fair. Look, I'll tell you what I feel about it. I feel it's an area, it's a commitment which is going to come under very, very sort of relentless bombardment from the Conservatives. And therefore, Labour has to make it bulletproof. It has to stress test it. I personally support the concept of borrowing to invest. I think we will not get out of the economic mire we're in without raising levels of both public and private investment in the country. I think that Rachel Reeves is right, however, to say that this commitment will be subject to some very strenuous fiscal tests. I mean, she wants to see debt as a proportion of GDP falling over the parliament. She will judge whether how much borrowing a Labour government could take on against both the overall economic performance of the country and whether the economy is growing, but also the cost of that borrowing, what interest rates are. So I think those are the governing rules that she's subjected the £28 billion
to. So would it and be if it better needs, if it hadn't been announced in the first place?
I think the concept was absolutely sound. I support it. I personally wouldn't have chosen a figure. Because I think that your ability to pursue this policy of investment, borrowing to invest, which, as I say, I think is right, will depend on the economic circumstances at the time. And therefore, to sort of pre-announce a figure so far in advance was not realistic. But we'll see. If it needs further clarification, I'm sure it will receive it.
That figure they've done has been a gift to the Tories.
Yeah, so we're putting our finger on, really, the Labour's strategic question, right, which is they got this, the £28 billion is pretty much one of the very few things, they're big things they're saying. So is it better to say what, to say some big things where you can get attacked, but you are saying some big things, or is it better to say almost nothing? And if you say almost nothing, you have Labour's big vulnerability, which is its only vulnerability really in this election, which is people think either they know what they think and they aren't saying, or they don't know what they think. And then the electorate aren't sure which of those is worse. And they think that about Starmer. If I was Sunak, it's almost the only glint of light for the Conservatives, that. And it's a strategic dilemma that's impossible for oppositions to avoid. But now Labour has to face it. I think with this £28 billion, it's quite a good test case. My choice, I think, along with Peter, would be probably to do reassurance. I think the Tories are in enough trouble that it would be better to effectively end up saying nothing, take the heat for that, make the Tories chase you over nothing and say you're dangerous, but be able to say, well, we're not, you know, people then sort of saying they're vague. It doesn't, that attack wouldn't really hold. So that would be my inclination. I wouldn't have the figure. I would play down the policy and I would take the heat for that. That's probably how I would play. Electorally, let's leave aside, people are listening to this thinking how aggravating that is for them as voters. But I'm talking about the Labour Party making an electoral choice.
But I think Labour were emboldened in the first place to make that choice of a number by the Inflation Reduction Act of Biden in the US, of just pumping billions and billions of dollars into sort of broadly green infrastructure. And I think that Labour do need something, not too many things, to build a sense of optimism and momentum and enthusiasm about what might change in the country as a result of their election. And this is, as Danny says, is one of the few things where they've really crystallised an idea. It is risky. There is always a kind of differential risk that governing parties and opposition parties face. You know, we're going to have a budget in March. The budget will end up moving around 28 billion or something around like that. And everyone just sort of looks at it in and sort of says, oh, yeah, that's fine. The, you know, the government is proposing, has a black hole for billions of pounds worth of public spending cuts that Labour can attack them on, but it seems so sort of amorphous that it's hard to. Whereas when you're in opposition, you know, certainly when I was working for the Liberal Democrats, we'd make a commitment for like, you know, £4 million or something, a rounding error, and then suddenly an explosion of literature criticising you for your kind of reckless spending.
But Polly, you've got to remember where Labour's come from. You know, Jeremy Corbyn, all the extremists, the Momentum organisation, the far left who dominate, capture the Labour Party's leadership and dominated it. Keir Starmer has got to provide absolutely cast-iron evidence that Labour has changed, that he has taken the Labour Party out of the grip of Corbyn and all that that represented, including spending zillions on heaven knows what. So he's absolutely core to Starmer's strategy is reassurance, in my view, and he's got to pursue that right up until polling day in order to win. But as Times focus groups have also indicated during the last year, people are unsure what Starmer and the Labour Party stand for. So what I would do additionally is sharpen up the policy side, sharpen up the policy offer that Labour's making. I'm not talking about encyclopedias of sort of detail of, you know, which over which the Conservatives will sort of run riot. But I think that what he has in the five missions are very good building blocks for this. And I think as the election comes nearer, he'll probably, from within the five missions, need to focus perhaps on two. One certainly would be the economy. I would suggest the other is the National Health Service. And I think that that combination of reassurance and the sort of sharpening up of the offer is what we need to see from Starmer in the coming months if he's going to allay those public fears. He needs trust, given where we've come from. But he also needs to make a bit clearer what you're voting for Labour to get.
Is it a problem, though, that as we go into the election year, we're still at the stage where people don't really know what Keir Starmer's all about?
Well, your focus group suggests that. I think that that is becoming less of a problem, but it is still nonetheless an issue. And I think that the Labour strategists have got to address it.
I don't think it is becoming less of a problem. So I think it's inevitable for two reasons. One is it's all oppositions will face this problem, the choice between being alarming to people and people thinking they stand for nothing. But secondly, Keir Starmer has a particular problem because he doesn't know what he thinks about lots of things. And he's still making up his mind. He is moving. If you look at his, you know, anybody, challenge anybody to read a biography of Keir Starmer, as I have done on two occasions, and reach the end of it and think, I really understand where this guy's coming from. I just don't. And I think that is definitely a problem with him. We had this problem, by the way, just now with Rishi Sunak. Lots of politicians have this problem, but I think he has it particularly acutely. And that is definitely a weakness. So set against the strategy that he's pursuing.
Can I half agree with Danny? I think Danny, he knows a lot more of what he thinks and what he intends to do than you give him credit for. But here's the point. I think Keir Starmer has been on a journey since he was elected leader of the Labour Party in 2020, you know, three years ago. I think he's been confronted with issues and policy areas that he hadn't had to think about very deeply beforehand, not just in the foreign policy sphere and international national security, but in other areas too. And I think he shouldn't be afraid of saying, actually, I have rethought some things, or I have developed my views, or I have been on a journey, or, you know, confronted with this, it has challenged my previous thinking.
That's better, isn't it, than in pretending that he didn't want to say that this was what he thought and now this is what he thinks and those two things are now opposite.
It's okay, right, to have him not to have thought deeply about how to make the transition to a net zero economy when he was Director of Public Prosecutions, right? Like, I'm fine
it's
with that.
It's a good point.
But that's where this is such an obvious place to add economic credibility and your kind of green credentials and have a story that is about growth and opportunity and investment. And so for all of what Peter and Danny have said, that seems to me to reinforce the idea that they should not resile from this commitment even if, of course, you don't just get in and spend $28 billion on day one, because that is a really surefire way to waste money. You have to build up, you have to have credible projects, you have to have good fiscal tests, good investment tests for it. But they absolutely should not water this down to the point of homeopathic disappearance.
Now, obviously, we've talked a lot about what's happening in the election, we assume, this year, unless you believe polling is going to happen in 2025. But let's talk about, because it's one of the biggest election years in history, because more than 60 countries representing half the world's population, some 4 billion people, will hold some sort of regional, legislative and presidential elections this year. So we asked you all to bring in an election to talk about. And Polly, the one you've chosen comes first, so let's start with you.
So on the 13th of January, the 26 million citizens, I guess probably not the children, but are going to the polls in Taiwan. The president from the Democratic Progressive Party, Tsai Ing-wen, is stepping down at the end of her term of office. And it's basically a competition between the DPP, the Green coalition, who are broadly pro-independence for Taiwan, and the two blue parties, the KMT, Kuomintang, apologies to all East Asian listeners for my terrible accent, and the Taiwanese People's Party. Now, there was in the autumn of last year a sort of lengthy discussion between those two blue parties who are more pro-China, potentially pro-reunification, though it's quite complicated, about joining a ticket, because between them they might have enough votes to be able to defeat the DPP, which would be, of course, geostrategic importance, because this status of Taiwan, which China claims ownership of, and where the US has this strategic ambiguity about whether they would protect Taiwan against a Chinese invasion. Those coalition talks fell apart, and so there are now three candidates. And it did look like the DPP would be a kind of a shoo-in, but actually the polls have narrowed. It's only 11 days from now. It seems it's possible that the DPP won't win, but the whole debate is being massively affected by, I think, what we're seeing, increasing numbers of elections, which is disinformation, misinformation, AI-generated content dominating social media, including on TikTok, and a lot of concern that that is being driven by China in order to get a more Chinese-friendly government installed in Taiwan.
I mean, from our point of view, I think the outcome of the Taiwan election that we want is one that supports the status quo, which is neither pro-independence or pro-reunification. Supports the status quo, because that's the only one that will give stability to that part of the world and to the and for the rest of us.
But it's so interesting the way the election, you know, elections being played out, with lots of disinformation from overseas, and actually one of the big defining questions is outward looking. Normally we think of elections being very domestic and, you know, taxes and schools and hospitals, but like a fundamental question of your place in the world being sort of on the ticket.
And the tension, as you can imagine, you know, from reporting in Taiwan, is incredibly high, both because of the context of Ukraine, where, you know, a more Western-aligned government came into conflict essentially with Russia and led to a Russian invasion, and also, of course, the escalations that we've seen in Hong Kong over the last several years in terms of China's relationship there.
Well, in fact, you mentioned Ukraine. So I'll come back a bit closer to home. And the European, the EU elections taking place to the European Parliament this year. This is your pick, Peter, in June.
My pick, because all of the 27 member states of the European Union will be having elections this year for the European Parliament. It may not be an overwhelming turnout, but there will be, in effect, a referendum in each of those countries on the performance of their national governments. It will be like a sort of midterm verdict that's being offered. And I think from what you can see at the moment, if you look at the sort of big four member states, in Germany, the centre-right and far-right AfD look as if they're doing well. In France, Macron running out of steam slightly, and the far-left party headed by Le Pen ahead in the polls. Italy, Meloni doing well with her far-right group. The only of one of the four is Spain, which has a sort of left-led government, and the left may well do better in Spain from a very low base from the previous election. And I think the outcome is going to be this. You will see the centre parties and the Greens doing less well than they want, somewhat in retreat. and the further right parties are gaining. And I think the implication of that for policy is that migration will become an even bigger issue in Europe than it is at the moment. I would say it's broadly about number one on the EU's agenda and will remain so for the next 4 years. But I think the other consequence is that with the Greens sort of slightly receding, I think that those parties on the right who are concerned about the costs of the net zero transition, the energy transition, on businesses and consumers will start to sort of quibble, and they'll be saying, look, come on, is this the best way? Does it have to be done at this breakneck speed? Does it have to be done with these costs? Can't we wait for sort of technology and innovation to emerge to see whether we can do this in a simpler way? I'm not saying there's going to be a lowering of ambition, but I think the influence that they will have will lead to a reconsideration of the route and the speed that change takes place.
The interesting thing will be whether we can discern patterns at all, because often it just moves about in all sorts of countries due to domestic factors. One of the most, hilarious bits of television I've ever done was being on the BBC's European election night special, and it was honestly 2:30 in the morning, and Emily Maitlis was in front of this big map explaining to people that there'd been a shift from the Latvian People's Front to the People's Front of Latvia. And then they would come to me to comment, and I didn't know who either of these parties were.
You didn't think that my distillation was simple enough.
The truth is, I think you're right. So I think there will be a shift towards populism on the right, partly because there is this shift going on in general in what the right-wing electorates are as they move from sort of more business-orientated parties to parties with a larger rural working class support, which they've always had. It's just a question of emphasis. They've always had that to some extent.
It's really interesting. Obviously, it's the first ones where we haven't taken part after we accidentally took part in 2019 because Theresa May forgot to leave in time. Danny, you've picked out, because you wrote in your column, in your Times column, it's the American election, not the British election, which has the greater capacity to tear our ship of state from its moorings.
Yeah, I feel a bit clunking after you've both chosen such sophisticated examples.
You went for the blindingly obvious.
I went for the blindingly obvious. But I do, you know, despite sort of getting embarrassed when I saw what you were going to choose and thinking maybe I should choose something more exotic, I've come back to this because I do think it is pretty critical.
Yeah.
I think, you know, so there are some people who think Donald Trump will certainly not be elected Freudian slip. Donald Trump will certainly not be elected because, you know, he is, you know, he's so obviously unsuitable for office. He's going to be, you know, halfway to jail by then and prosecuted. He's too old. You know, it's obvious he's going mad. That sort of thing. I've had all that since I wrote my column. I absolutely do not think you can rule out the really quite large chance that he will win the presidency, because he will very likely be the Republican candidate. I think that's overwhelmingly likely. And then if you're the Republican candidate and there's a Democrat president, you've got a very good chance of winning. And if he did win, the consequences for the Western Alliance, which he would then be the sort of the de facto leader just because of their defence expenditure and our historical links, will be in crisis. And this will affect everything that we do in the world, on the world stage.
Can I tell you about the WhatsApp exchange I had with the legendary Republican pollster in the United States, Frank Luntz?
Yes, please.
Over the weekend, he said of Trump, the more indictments, the higher he climbs, the more people that kick him off the ballot, the better he does. The wilder the claims, the more positive the responses. The truth is, we are spiralling downward and there is no bottom.
Yeah.
And then end up, so shall we do an interview together on this? So we might have him on.
Frank at one point kind of championed the sort of cause of like Ross Perot and the kind of populist stream, and he then came to the conclusion it was incredibly destructive.
Yeah,
I think it's partly because of the international influence of it.
Well, plenty for us to look at there. The US elections, the European Parliament elections, and Taiwan, which comes first. Polly McKenzie, Peter Madison, Daniel Finkelstein, good to see you all. Looking forward to this year. It's going to be exciting. That was How to Win an Election.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.